Here we are, Ruth chapter 1, verse 12. Turn again, my daughters. Who's talking? Someone help me. Naomi's talking. Turn again, my daughters. Who's she talking to? Daughters-in-law, Ruth and Orpah. Good. Turn again, my daughters. Go your way, for I'm too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, if I should have a husband also tonight and should also bear sons, would you hang around? Would you tarry for them till they were grown? Would you stay for them from having husbands? Nay, my daughters, for it grieves me much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. And they lifted up their voice and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clave unto her. And she said, behold, thy sister-in-law is gone back unto her people and unto her gods. Return thou after thy sister-in-law. And Ruth said, entreat me not to leave thee or to return from following after thee. For whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God my God. Where you die, will I die, and there will I be buried, and the Lord do to me, and more also, if aught but death part thee and me. Verse 18, when she saw that she was steadfastly minded to go with her, then she left speaking unto her. So they too went until they came to Bethlehem, and it came to pass, when they were come to Bethlehem, that all the city was moved about them, and they said, is this Naomi? And she said unto them, call me not Naomi, but call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, and the Lord has brought me home again empty. Why then do you call me Naomi, seeing the Lord has testified against me, and the Almighty has afflicted me? So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, with her, in which returned out of the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem in the beginning of the barley harvest. And Naomi had a kinsman of her husband's, a mighty man of wealth of the family of Elimelech, and his name was Boaz. Well, that's good stuff. And we're going to be looking at verses 19 of chapter 1 through verse 1 of chapter 2 today. But before we do, I want to talk to us about a couple things. Number one, you'll look at verse 19. They too went until they came to Bethlehem, and it came to pass when they were come to Bethlehem that all the city was moved about them. So here's, remember, our line of travel. There they are in, let me find the light. There we are. There we are in the traveling west from Moab into past Jerusalem, you might notice, down to Bethlehem. So if you're like me, you're sitting there thinking, okay, big deal. The whole town was at unrest. Is this like, you know, DuPont, Indiana, where there's 300 people? And what were they doing? Were they all hanging out at the 7-Eleven waiting to hear some new gossip? So I got to thinking about that. Greg, come up here and tell us what you found out about the size of Bethlehem at the time, okay? You need to put that somewhere on your shirt so they can hear you.
All right. Clicker here, okay? And I've got about 5 minutes to discuss what's going on here. And it's a big deal to understand why it's a big deal and to see why the whole town was in an uproar. Really need to speak a little bit to the the population of Bethlehem, Judah. And that's how we're going to kind of answer this question. And so we are talking about Bethlehem, Judah. There are two. We already discussed that. There's one up in Zebulun. We're talking about the one here that was given to the tribe of Judah. And that's about 6 miles south of Jerusalem. So that's the town we're talking about, just to make sure that we're all on the same sheet of music. And here, this is the two points that I'm going to try and discuss when it comes to identifying the population of Bethlehem, Judah. I'm going to go first to the Bible, like Pastor Bill always tells us to do, to try and find anything that indicates its population. And then we're going to go into the verses that we're talking about today, 19 through 21, and see what happens at the arrival of Naomi and Ruth that might indicate the population of Bethlehem, Judah. Really, really linear, real simple. Okay, so when was Bethlehem, Judah established? We saw that in Joshua 15 when, anybody knows in Joshua 15, that's when the lands were allotted to all the 12 tribes of Israel. So what I saw in Joshua 15 was that it listed all the towns and cities that were given to the tribe of Judah. And it was Bethlehem, Judah was not even mentioned in there. So it kind of indicated to me that it was insignificant in size to not even get a mention there in Joshua 15. And I kind of referenced that with Joshua 19, where the other Bethlehem from Zebulun was mentioned in verse 19 of Joshua. So I kind of thought, okay, the Bethlehem and Zebulun must be quite larger than the one here in Bethlehem, Judah. So when was it was established there? Probably in the late or early 1400s BC, right? And it was reasonably populated for about 200 to 300 years till we get to Ruth and Naomi's time, which was roughly around 1100 BC. So it was populated between that 200 and 300 years. But you got to understand there was a famine and a lot of stuff going on that might have shortened the population or minimized the population of Bethlehem, Judah. And we see in 1:1 of Ruth 1:1 where that famine was mentioned. So, and also went to Ezra and Nehemiah, and those two passages kind of gave me hard numbers of Bethlehem, Judah, because what's going on here is all the exiled Jews are coming back into Judah, and he's doing like a census there to gather who and just get the sizes of the cities and the tribes of Judah that are coming back in. So Ezra and Nehemiah have the same account of like hard numbers of Bethlehem, Judah. And if you look at it, it's 123 mentioned in Ezra, 221, and about 148. But in Nehemiah, it kind of lumped them, Bethlehem, Judah, and Netophah together. But just realize that those numbers are only the men, the heads of the family, and the men of or the males of age, 18 or older. So if you kind of times that number, probably by about 2 or 3, you get about 300-400 people of Bethlehem, Judah. So that kind of gives us an indication. But also remember that this is 603 years after the time frame that we're talking about. Just to get a point of reference, though, of the size of the city. And that kind of just gave me the size of the city. So we're roughly looking at from this about 300 to 400, well, about between 3 and maybe 1,000 people. But we're talking hundreds, not thousands, is what the point I'm getting at. And also, I found in Micah, it kind of, it described Bethlehem, Judah, it showed a little bit of its, or indicated a little bit of its population. If you look in there, that prophecy was of the Messiah, but it said that out of Bethlehem, you're so insignificant, and it just kind of indicated that it's still after, we're talking 750, so about 400 years after the time of Ruth and Naomi, we're still talking about a small place population-wise. If you can kind of make that connection, Micah is prophesying the Messiah coming out of a small place in Bethlehem. You're minuscule is what I'm trying to say. So that kind of indicates that the population is really small. And it all points to this, again, this undersized population of Bethlehem, Judah. So we're talking hundreds, not thousands. Now, we're going to get into the verses for today and what they might indicate as far as population is concerned and how small this town is and why the whole town would be in uproar. This is my hometown. It's kind of grown since I've been there. I mean, it was 1800 back in the 80s, but it has grown. And the thing I want to make a point is here that even though this is a town of 3,000 of where I grew up, we're talking thousands here, and we're talking maybe hundreds to 1,000 in Bethlehem, Judah. Everybody knows everybody's business in my hometown. My wife can attest to that. If I go down out the main town speeding 10 miles over the speed limit, someone's going to know, and someone's going to tell my dad or my mom. So, and that's happened before in high school. So you can see where the whole town would know what people are doing here. So in verse 19, it said that the city was moved about them, and they said, is this Naomi? So in a small town, you would know that anybody coming in and out of there, they would know. And it's not uncommon for this, in a small town, to know who's coming in and out. And in verse 22, it said Bethlehem was in the beginning of a barley harvest. So if you're talking, so as Ruth and Naomi are coming in, there's only one road into this small town. Just like if you saw the main town in my hometown, there's only one way into the town. So the barley fields are all outside of Bethlehem, Judah. So as she's rolling, or she's walking into the town, all the people are out in the fields harvesting the barley. So they would see her walking in town. So the whole town is out there harvesting the fields. They just come out of a famine. So they would all be out there harvesting. They would see Ruth and Naomi coming in and recognize her. In Ruth 2:4, Boaz came from Bethlehem just to indicate that the fields were outside of the city. So as you can see that just the size of this city, everybody would know that. And that's why it was all up in an uproar, that they would know who Naomi was when she's coming into the town. And just to draw the conclusion, you can't really get the exact size of Bethlehem, Judah in the scriptures, but there are indicators to show that this is really a small town.
I really appreciate that. That took some work. Thank you, Brother Greg. I really appreciate it. Okay, so you're going to curtsy? You're allowed to curtsy if you like. So that was really good. So you might have got the whole Bethlehem, you're small, out of Micah. That's before the captivity. Okay, so if it's considered puny before the captivity, and they only had 150 men after the captivity, that's the difference between speaking as an engineer and speaking as an operator. It's 150. It said 120, some 140, 150. And so in any case, if you have 150 men, you're talking about, I really appreciate you breaking that down. Now, the question I had this week as well was, what about Elimelech's fields? Now, I had Brother Dick mention to me, well, you know, I mean, you can have a number of jobs. Nothing says you had to be a farmer. That's true. That's true. Nothing says you have to be a farmer. You could be a cooper. What's a cooper? Barrel maker. That's right. Huh? Not close. But anyway, you could be a cobbler, a cooper, a coppersmith, as Greg Cosia over here said, another bald guy with facial hair. First of all, let's look at chapter 4, verse 3 of Ruth. And let's notice that, in fact, they did have some fields. All right. And I wouldn't have known this if I didn't see this verse. So it is an assumption, unless we have this verse, that Elimelech had any fields. So look at verse 4, chapter 4 and verse 1. Then went Boaz up to the gate and sat down there, and behold, the kinsman of whom Boaz spoke came by, unto whom he said, Ho, such a one, turn aside, sit down here. And he turned aside and sat down. And we'll talk about this text when we get to it. He took 10 men of elders of the city and said, Sit down over here. They sat down. And he said to them, The kinsman Naomi that has come again out of the country of Moab sells a parcel of land, which was our brother Elimelech. So Elimelech and Naomi did have some property. They had some land. So what we don't know is how big it was, but it seems like it was substantial, or they wouldn't be meeting about it, is what I'm guessing. Now the question is, it's barley harvest. Doesn't it seem like it's the wrong timing for her to be coming home? And if so, why? She has land, apparently. Elimelech, her husband, had land. Because the Levitical law does leave room in Leviticus chapter 25 for an impoverished Jew to sell his land, but then a next of kin can redeem it. And really all that's attached to it. So you see later on here in chapter 4, Boaz is saying, I'll redeem the land. And oh, by the way, you get a Moabite woman with it. And so that's how Boaz ends up with Ruth. But the question is, why would it be just horrible timing, humanly speaking, to come at barley harvest? Yes, Sister Turner. What's that? You know, that's true. She said, so she doesn't have to get on Harmony, eHarmony.com. They're all right there in the barley fields. They're running the joint. Huh?
I mean, you're adding to your labor, right?
Yeah, that's true, adding to your labor. But what I'm wondering is there any barley in the field?
It's entirely possible her field was planted by someone who doesn't own the field.
That's a point you brought up, isn't it? That it could be that we just have theft happening and someone's using their field because they've been gone for how long now? How do we know 10 years, Greg? At least 10 years. Well, chapter 4, verse 3 leads us to believe that it's still in Naomi's possession. Because it says that she is selling it. She's about to sell it. She is selling it. So it's possible. How do we know it might? Chapter 1, verse 4. The two sons took wives of the women of Moab, and they dwelled there about 10 years at the end of the verse. So we know at least 10 years have passed. We know that Naomi is not a spring chicken anymore. You say, well, how do you know that? Well, because they were kind of shocked at her appearance in verse 19 of chapter 1. You might be thinking, well, it might be because they weren't expecting to see her. That's true. But Naomi follows it up with, why are you calling me a name that means pleasantness? Call me instead a name that means bitterness. So I don't know how she looked, but she was 10 years older and life had been difficult on her. Go ahead. Seems like it. That's a good point. She might have been wearing different things. Maybe they left town before they were too poverty stricken. Remember, Judges, the book of Judges tells us they're in a time of peace. And remember that left-handed judge, remember his name? Ehud, that's right. Pull the cubit long, who said that? Was that you, Brother Doug? Pull that cubit long, okay, Ryan. Pull that cubit long dagger off his right thigh and shoved it into the fat one. King Eglon, remember him? What a great name. I can't think of a better name for a rotund king, okay? Eglon, all right? And so that's how I remember it. I think of raising Cain to remember it was Cain who killed Abel, and I think of Eglon to remember about that was the one who ate up the entire cubit-long dagger, okay? Haft and all, it says. Haft and all. All right, so anyway, take that into account. Sorry, so anyway, now we know after that passage in the book of Judges, we know that the people of Israel pursued the Moabites and pretty much decimated them. And I don't mean that literally for all you Adrian monks in the room. I don't mean he reduced them to one-tenth. I'm saying they just pretty much destroyed them, okay? And so there is a lot of freedom to travel to Moab that didn't used to be there. 80 years of peace and no Moabite army leaves room for a lot of traveling into Moab. And so we have Ruth coming into town now, and after about 10 years, it's possible someone was growing barley on her fields. So, all of a sudden, she's a woman without a husband and without sons, and she may have a dilemma of kicking someone, a squatter, as it were, off of her land. Anyone in OIF 1 here? Anyone? Remember we moved into Baghdad and everyone lived in a home that wasn't theirs? And it was difficult to just know, okay, who owns what? And then the U.S., we became the world's largest squatters there in Baghdad and lived everywhere. But in any case, I am pretty certain that if you can get free fields for your crops and your family can eat and all you have to do is be out there to sow the barley, you may very well ask for forgiveness later and just use the woman's field who left. Elimelech, who knows if they even knew Elimelech died at that point. All right, so you have barley harvest. Anyone know when that was, what time of the year that might have been? Say again, please, over here. Okay, yeah, that's about right, Christine. Thank you. So her study Bible says April, and that's about right. And the reason we know that is because there was another festival that took place around about, it's now called Pentecost. But just before Pentecost was this Feast of the First Fruits. And what would happen to the first fruits is that you can read about this in the book of Leviticus. I'm sure you'll do that today. They go out in the field and get the first waving of barley in the field, and they come and offer it before the Lord in the tabernacle. All right, good. Well, we've already learned quite a bit today, haven't we? So let's see here. So Ruth stood between, by the way, consider the disobedient missionary family. I was talking with someone about this today. We are often wondering what kind of role did God have in reaching the Gentiles in the Old Testament. Now, what did we learn about Moab out of Deuteronomy 1, Deuteronomy 2? What did we learn about them? We already know that they're Lot's descendants, which makes them related to Abraham, right? What did we hear about Deuteronomy 1 and 2 when the Israelites are traveling from Egypt to Canaan?
They didn't offer food.
Well, that's correct. Moab did not offer them food. In fact, they tried to have them what? With a prophet. Have them cursed. Thanks, Ryan. So they tried to have him cursed with a prophet, Balaam. Not so good. Every time he went into a trance, he ended up blessing the children of Israel and cursing the Moabites. That's a rough start to that relationship. In any case, it is tough. Yeah, it happens to me sometimes. I know not to you. But God said to them, you cannot have that land. You go around. I've given that to the descendants of Moab. You remember that? I've given that to the descendants of Lot through Moab. All right, so God is looking out for promise. It's almost like they have their own promised land. Who was the other son and grandson of Lot? Not just Moab, but a guy named Ammon. all right? And that was the father of the Ammonites. So you have the Ammonites, the Moabites, and then you have this twin brother of Jacob. What was his name? Esau. I don't know if they're necessarily identical twins, though. Esau is born, and he becomes Edom. It says five or six times in Genesis 36 that Edom and Esau are the same guys. And so you have Edom, which is modern-day Jordan. Okay, so you have Jordan, Moab, Ammon, all very much closely related to Abraham. And God says to each, to the Israelites, concerning each of those three nations, you cannot have their land, it's not yours. He says that to the Israelites. Now, the question a lot of people have is, you know, we always talk about that question. What about the pygmy and wherever, we can never really find one, that is really seeking after God? And they would get saved if they only had but a missionary. And you know, we always make up those things to incriminate God. And so the question really is, did God pay any attention to the Old Testament heathen? Or as they say in the South, heathern. Do they? Did he? You know, I mean, did he do anything to evangelize Moab at all? Well, the slide is a little misleading, isn't it? Elimelech. A man whose name means the Lord is my king is going to Moab, and he is a witness of the one true God in Moab. And we're not even sure if he was there under the, what we would call, think about it now, hashtag, the perfect will of God. We make up wonderful things that are. All right, so anyways, you have this perfect will of God. We're not sure if Elimelech and Ruth are there in the perfect will of God. Now, we have a situation like that with a guy by the name of Jonah. Jonah is told to go to Nineveh, the capital city of Assyria, now known as Mosul. And he's told to go there and be a missionary to those non-Jews. And Jonah says, well, I think that those folks in Tarshish need a missionary too. And so he thinks he's heading west, and he does for a little while, but he puts the fleece out there. Notice I'm using popular language. He puts a fleece out there. He wants to see if a door will open. And he says, if there's a ship in Joppa, I'm out of there. Because obviously God is wanting me to not go to Nineveh if he allows me to get on a ship that heads west. Okay, so we're using all kinds of popular terminology here on purpose because this is pop Christianity. This is the kind of stuff that makes Christian book industries thrive because people are always looking for the inside track. It's not very often anyone's interested in sitting quietly before the Lord and waiting for leadership. Very, 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 very seldom. Usually we're buying the newest book or attending the newest Bible study to tell us what to do next. And very rarely are we following after God. So what we don't know is whether or not Elimelech is actually told to go to Moab. But wouldn't you know it? Less than 300 years after they pass by Moab, after they're blessed by a Moabite prophet who we have no reason to think is in heaven today, after they're cursed, God sends Moab a missionary by the name of Elimelech. A missionary family. Now you say, well, I don't know. How do we even know they're walking with God? We don't. But we know this. They were worshipers of Jehovah. Because all through the rest of chapter 1, we have Ruth, as lousy as a testimony as Naomi was. And look, be easy on me as I'm being easy on Naomi. She was the one who said she was bitter. And so her bitter testimony somehow was vibrant enough to still influence a woman by the name of Ruth to turn from her Chemosh God of the Moabites over to Jehovah. So there was a witness for Jehovah in Moab in the Old Testament. That's amazing to me. And it's not the only situation because, like I've said a couple weeks ago, the wise men may have come from Moab because they're citing a prophecy that was given by the Moabite prophet Balaam about some star that's supposed to tell of a king. So all of a sudden, we not only have a missionary maybe going to Moab and Ruth, but we have missionaries coming from Moab and Matthew. See, God is faithful to make a witness of himself among all nations. Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God and the firmament displays his handiwork. Day into day utters their speech, night into night. There is no tongue where their voice is not heard. Isn't that amazing? Go ahead, brother.
Your testimony.
Yes, you're right. In spite of, and it was an imperfect testimony is all I'm saying.
Right.
There might have been a solid testimony, but like all of us, we have days that are better than others, don't we? Better than others. Now, I understand we read the book of Acts and we come away thinking the Apostle Paul had a cape on that said AP on the back. But the truth is, between those Sabbath days we're told about, he had some days where I'm sure that he cursed itchy feet and smelly underarms. Okay? He probably hated his job some days. You say, oh, no, probably he was a saint. No, it only says that in the Renaissance art. Okay? We don't see any halos on him in the book of Acts. There were probably days when he fussed at his fellow travelers. You know? And when you find just in, was it Acts 12, 13, 14, when he's fussing with Barnabas about Mark. Do you remember? Mark had a cousin or a nephew, depending on what version of the Bible you have, that says that he didn't get along well with Paul. And so there was a strife between them. Yes, very good. And then we find in the book of Galatians where Paul is actually fussing with what other apostle? Peter. So there were days when Paul would not have been accused of writing the latest book on making friends and influencing people. There would have been days, okay? So verse 19, we find him. You find the three ladies coming back to Bethlehem. Came to pass when they were come to Bethlehem that all the city was moved about them, and they said, "Is this Naomi?" In verse 20, and she, Naomi, said to them, "Call me not Naomi, but call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me." Well, we have to recognize some good things about her theology here. Throw them out at me. Is she wrong? So what's true about what she said? She gave God the credit for the bad, too. We are afraid and I think embarrassed for God when he doesn't need anyone defending him. And that's how cults a lot of the time start, is we're embarrassed for God. And so we start saying stuff that's not in the Bible. And so Naomi makes no bones about it. She says, "He made me bitter." And we don't find anywhere, like in Job, where God comes back and thunders out of a whirlwind. "Ah, Job, who are you?" We don't see that here. And by the way, Job was written by the time Ruth was here. I don't know if Job was an influence in Ruth's life, but there were some stories in the Old Testament that might have influenced Ruth's understanding of bitterness. Do you remember in Exodus 15? Do you remember the children of Israel being brought out of the land of Egypt? They travel 3 days, and they are now very thirsty. And God leads them besides particular waters. What kind of waters were they? Bitter, and they're called Mara. That's right. And so we find that God leads us besides bitter waters. Ruth and Naomi gave God the credit. Who are you going to give the credit for leading you besides bitter waters? And Moses said, "Well, God brought us here." Now, he made them sweet, too, didn't he? Hey, hold your place here. Look one book forward. Look one book forward to the first chapter of 1 Samuel. Look at verse 9. Why are we turning this? It's not like you, Pastor Bill. Yeah, I know. I don't know what I'm thinking. Verse 9. So Hannah rose up after they had eaten in Shiloh and after they had drunk. Now Eli the priest sat upon a seat by a post of the temple of the Lord, and she was in bitterness of soul and prayed to the Lord and wept sore. And she vowed a vow and said, "O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the afflictions of thine handmaid and remember me and not forget thine handmaid, but will give unto thine handmaid a man child, then I will give him unto the Lord all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head." It came to pass as she continued praying before the Lord that Eli marked her mouth. Now, that's not as harsh as it might sound. It means he looked at it and took note. Now, Hannah, she spoke in her heart. Only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. Therefore, Eli thought that she had been drinking. And Eli said to her, "How long will you be drunk? Put away thy voice, thy wine from thee." Now, listen, isn't this amazing, these parallels in Scripture? Where else was a group of people that were filled with the Spirit accused of being drunk? Yeah, Acts 2 of Pentecost. That's right. Now, verse 15, and Hannah answered and said, "No, my Lord, I am a woman of sorrowful spirit. I have not drunk neither wine or strong drink, but have poured out my soul before the Lord." So you have a woman who says, in the bitterness of her heart, she cried out. And then, by the way, whose mother did she end up being? Samuel. That's right. Good. So back to Ruth 1. So this is a theme in Scripture. And God says, "Moses, Naomi, Job, Hannah, you go ahead and blame me for the bitterness happening in your life." All right. Now, look at the very next verse. "I went out full, and the Lord has brought me home again empty." What goes through your mind when you're reading that, knowing the story thus far? What do you mean?
Well, you know, you just got this daughter-in-law who didn't have to come. Who could have stayed home. I come home empty. Well, I got Ruth here. You got some fields. You know, you're doing all right.
Good, Jim. That's right. That's right. She didn't come home empty. She came home with Ruth. The perspective was somewhat warped, a little skewed. Emotionally, that happens to us sometimes, doesn't it? Now, what else is wrong with that statement? That's true. We've talked about she still has property. But what's... All right, James? Very good. They left because there was a famine. We're not full. No, you didn't. But when you're in the middle of bitterness, you forget what things were really like. Same thing happened to the children of Israel, right? Man, back in Egypt, we had poolside seats, garlics, leeks, onions. We had pretty girls with feathers waving over us to keep us cool. And they fed us bonbons and grapes all day long. And life was sweet on the other side of the Nile. That's the kind of stuff they said in the wilderness, folks. They must have forgot that they were made to find their own stubble to make bricks with. They forgot real fast. We're talking weeks when they were sitting at the foot of Mount Sinai and Aaron is up there getting the... Or, no, he wasn't. He was down there getting something else. Moses was up on Mount Sinai getting the law. And Moses was up on Mount Sinai getting the law. And that's horrible, Jimmy. And Aaron is down there leading a revolt against God, saying dumb stuff like, "These are the gods that brought you out of Egypt." The gods that brought you out of Egypt. No, they don't exist. There's only one God brought to Egypt. But when you're in the middle of difficult times, we have a tendency to forget how bad things were or how good things were. So she's speaking out of distraughtness, isn't she? All right. The Lord has brought me home again. All right, so what else? What do you see as an interesting flip of terms by the writer of Ruth here between her saying the Lord has brought me home again empty? Really, that's how she left. Isn't it interesting that we see kind of two bookends here with chapters, right? In verse 1, you have what being the main event? Verse 1, famine. And now at the end of, how would you end? I think the chapter, for a change, the chapter break is perfectly placed. Harvest. That's right. So we have God setting the stage here for something. And so if you're done reading chapter 1, you haven't read chapters 2, 3, or 4, who are you going to assume is the great character in this book? Naomi, maybe, because of her returning to Moab, or maybe Ruth, because obviously she's being groomed to be the center stage. But who ends up being center stage? Yeah, and he's introduced in chapter 2, verse 1. God has a way of making sure that his pictures in the Old Testament end up being the heroes. Yeah. I'm not saying Naomi wasn't a great woman. I'm not saying Ruth wasn't a great woman, for surely they were. But God is always the hero of the story. All right. One last thing, and then I'll let you go. You might notice verse 1. Look at verse 1 the way that it's worded. It says, Boaz is a mighty man of wealth. Okay? Well, the ESV says worthy man. The ASV says mighty man of wealth. And you say, well, why are you paying attention to the other translations? Well, because 50% of you don't have a King James, for one thing. And for another thing, the King James is not always very even on how it translates it. For example, you might notice how it's translated in Joshua 1:14, Joshua 6:2, and Joshua 10:7. In the King James Version, it is not translated mighty man of wealth in those three verses. It's translated mighty man of valor. A strong man, a courageous man, someone who will stand in the gap and fight for his family, that kind of thing. Now, I understand that probably the same person didn't write Joshua that wrote Judges and Joshua that wrote Ruth. We think Samuel wrote Judges and Ruth. Okay? I get that. So, let's see what Judges translates it as. Well, both times the phrase is used in Judges, it is translated mighty man of valor. So, now, let's take this in. Here in Ruth chapter 2, verse 1, mighty man of wealth. It's the sixth time that phrase is used in the Hebrew. It's the first time the King James translators translated mighty man of wealth. And what do we take from that? Well, what we take from that is that one of the times in Judges is referring to Gideon, and one of the times in Judges is referring to Jephthah. What was Jephthah and what was Gideon? I'll give you a hint. It's in a particular book. They were judges. Good. We have Gideon being described as a mighty man of valor or a mighty man of wealth, depending on which translation you want to go with there. You have Jephthah, the judge, being seen as a mighty man of valor, mighty man of wealth, whichever translation you want to go there. And you have Ruth chapter 2, verse 1, where it's translated as mighty man of valor. So what you should get then is that there is something in common between Gideon, Jephthah, and Boaz. What is it? Yeah, very influential, very strong, very full of concern. As a matter of fact, you might find that they're all God-fearers. Look at verse 4 of chapter 2. Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they answered him, "The Lord bless you also." So we're talking about this capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. You see that? It should be translated Jehovah if you have a different version. Does anyone have that? Any other comments or questions about what we've talked about today?